Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. I'm Chris Higashi, the program manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to the 2012 Seattle Reads, the Submission by Amy Waldman. We thank the Ballard Branch for hosting us today. Special thank you to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. We also thank the Wallace Foundation for generous support. We also have support this year from Picador Books, Amy's publisher, and Talia Shear, the library marketing person for the Macmillan Group. We thank also our media sponsors, KUOW Public Radio, and the Seattle Times. And, of course, our independent bookstore partners. Today, University Bookstore is here with Amy's novel, For Sale. Okay, it is my great pleasure to welcome Amy Waldman to Seattle.
So thank you all for coming today. It's really a pleasure to be here. I want to thank, first of all, Chris for organizing not just my trip, but such thoughtful programming around the book as well. And I want to thank the Seattle Public Library and all its branches and the foundation as well, the Seattle Public Library Foundation, for making this possible. I've been telling people that as a first-time author, it's very hard to imagine anybody not related to you actually reading your book when you're sitting on it by yourself for several years working on it, and you certainly don't imagine a city taking it up. I would be thrilled for any town or city to choose this for a program, but Seattle in particular is such an honor given the history of this program, the lineage of writers they've had come for Seattle Reads, and it's just such a literary city. You know, I live in New York, and I've seen way more bookstores here in a much smaller city than you see, sadly, in New York. So it's really great to be here. I originally thought, oh, you know, a city reading your book, it's sort of just like a giant book club. But I was corrected in talking to a librarian, actually, about this, and she said it's different because a book club, you often gather with people who are very much like you. But when a town or city is discussing a book, part of the point is to bring very different people together for public conversations around a book. So it's great to be part of that. In case you haven't read the submission yet, very briefly, it tells the story of an anonymous competition to select a memorial for 9/11. I never directly call it September 11th in the book, so a 9/11-like event. But the jury meets and chooses a design called The Garden and then opens the envelope to learn the winner's name and learns that it's a Muslim American architect named Muhammad Khan. And they very quickly know this is going to pose some difficulties given this takes place about 2 years after the attacks, given where the country is. To complicate matters, the garden itself is ostensibly benign, beautiful garden, but once the identity of the designer is revealed, questions are raised about whether it in fact is an Islamic garden with which it shares elements in common. So that's sort of another layer of the controversy. So I mostly want to spend the time here answering your questions. I'm just going to do a very brief reading. So Muhammad Khan, the architect who wins the competition, this takes place before he enters. He is born and raised in Virginia. He was raised secular. He goes by Mo, not Muhammad. But after these attacks, he's in Los Angeles. He's trying to return to New York, and he's pulled aside for an interrogation at the airport. So the short section I'm going to read takes place at the end of this questioning. The interview ended as capriciously as it had begun. Without explanation, they asked to photograph and fingerprint him. Instead of refusing, as he believed was his right, he allowed them to press down his fingers as if he were a paralytic, an acquiescence that marked off the man who left the room from the one who had entered. At the agent's physical touch, the hand lifting his, there was a brief flare of fury, an impulse toward violence, then the almost instantaneous checking of it. Returning home, he found that they had pillaged his suitcase, crumpled his precisely folded shirts, unpaired his socks, uncapped his shampoo and toothpaste so that a nebulous ooze coated his toiletries. He appended the suitcase on the bed, dumped the toiletry kit in the trash, kicked the wastebasket to the wall. But his bitterness was overwhelmed by the magnitude of mourning around him. The city reeled, the air ashy, the people ashen, the attack site a separating wound you felt even when you didn't see it. One night, soon after his return, Mo walked toward the zone of destruction. The moonlight picked out a strange fine dust clinging to leaves and branches, and his toe rested on a paper scrap with charred edges. The eternal lights were off in the nearby office towers as if the city's animal appetites had been quelled. A quilt of the missing, bright portraits of tuxedoed men and lipsticked women had been pasted on fences and construction plywood, but the streets were empty, and for the first time in memory, he heard his own footsteps in New York City. He imagined, couldn't avoid it, the shaking hands that must have placed each of these photos on a photocopy machine, that roll of blue light, cold, mechanical hope, false hope. The centers of hundreds upon hundreds of webs of family, friends, work had been torn out. It staggered Mo, shamed him. These men who had given vent to their homicidal sanctimony had nothing to do with him, yet weren't entirely apart. They represented Islam no more than his own extended family did, but could he say they represented it less? He didn't know enough about his own religion to say. He was the middle-class Muslim son of an engineer, a profile not all that different from the terrorists. Raised in another society, raised religious, could he have become one of them? The question shuddered through him and left an uneasy residue. Behind a police sawhorse, an Indian man in a bedraggled white shirt and black bow tie held a sign. We are open. The man motioned to a tiny restaurant down the block, and although Mo wasn't hungry, he followed and ordered a sympathy chola. The waiter left him to the cook, who also served, and alone, Mo picked at his chickpeas and naan. Here, he could hear himself chew. What was it he was trying to see? He had been indifferent to the buildings when they stood, preferring more fluid forms to their stark brutality, their self-conscious monumentalism. But he had never felt violent toward them, as he sometimes had toward that awful Verizon building on Pearl Street. Now he wanted to fix their image, their worth, their place. They were living rebukes to nostalgia, these Goliaths that had crushed small businesses, vibrant streetscapes, generational continuities, and other romantic notions beneath their giant feet. Yet it was nostalgia he felt for them. A skyline was a collaboration, if an inadvertent one, between generations, seeming no less natural than a mountain range that had shuttered up from the earth. This new gap in space reversed time. Thank you.
So now I will open it to questions.
Yes. So I'm going to repeat the questions. Yeah. The question was about I spent time in Afghanistan and how difficult was it to really understand the culture and penetrate it as an outsider. I think as a reporter, one of the things you have to learn, which I'm not sure all reporters do, is that you will never fully understand another culture. And frankly, I'm not sure I fully understand America either. But, you know, I went into Afghanistan. I didn't know I would be going there when I first went and knew nothing, literally, about the country and didn't have, because it was when the war was still going on in the fall of 2001, didn't have access to a computer. You know, I couldn't get on the internet and look up a lot of information. So initially I was really in some kind of very pure way, just going blindly, going on what I saw and heard. I had a great translator then and on all my subsequent trips to Afghanistan, and that helped a lot. And my first translator was from Iran, but the later translators I worked with were from Afghanistan. And I feel so much of what I learned about the country was through them, not just translating what people said, but they explained the culture to me, but more than even explaining it, it was just in watching them, their relationships with their families, how they lived, how they practiced Islam, you know, all of these things, just partly by observing them, partly by listening to them. I do not understand everything at all, but I, you know, feel I got a decent sense of how people live, how war has affected them, because they had, you know, been through 30 years of war, essentially. In a weird way, people always want to know if being a woman was a handicap there, but I found it an advantage because men, they looked at me as some sort of kind of, I wasn't a man, I wasn't a woman, I was an American woman, just doing what American women do. So it wasn't that they would talk to commanders. They were very open with me because they didn't look at me like their wives. I was just a different breed. And as a woman, you can talk to women, and most male reporters could not do that. And so I felt incredibly lucky to have that access. And I often found that the women told the truth much more than the men. The men, I think, because they've been fighting and, you know, they are the ones kind of who have dealt with these successive wars and waves of rulers and so on. They've
adapting often involves sort of playing both sides and not being entirely forthright, whereas the women, I would always go to them to find out what really was going on. They were just much more honest often. So, but I felt very lucky to have that weigh in with women. So she asked, in my words, why I wrote the book. I think it's sort of the primal question for a writer in a way. I think, you know, the idea literally came to me during a conversation with a friend, sort of talking about the September 11th Memorial Competition and Mile In, and it sort of just popped into my head and stayed there. But I think it just intersected with so many things I had been consumed with after September 11th, but I think things I had even thought about before September 11th about what does it mean to be an American, who gets to be fully American, how do we respond to times of threat. And I had also become very interested in Islam because I was spending so much time in reporting in not just Afghanistan, but multiple Muslim countries and communities and so on. And so sort of trying to look at how both this country and this faith were, I felt, almost undergoing these identity crises about what would they be in the wake of this attack. I thought a lot about that. It came up in my reporting all the time. I suddenly just started, you know, there was no nonfiction book I felt I could write about that that would get at, because I had more questions than answers, and I feel like fiction is a much more suitable medium for questions in a lot of ways than nonfiction is. I also just became fascinated by this story of what would happen, how would we as a country respond, and who was Muhammad Khan, and trying to figure all that out. And I have a lot of friends now who've written books, and I always look at them and think, nobody else could have written the book that you wrote just because of their history and background and their passions and obsessions. And it does kind of have to be an obsession. And so I felt that way about this book, of just, this is the one for me. And when I started writing, it wasn't thinking about publishing or an audience or anything. It was just such a personal passion. You know, for 6 months I didn't tell anybody that I was even working on it, because it was just something I wanted to try and explore. So the question was about Claire Burwell, who is the sole family member who sits on the jury. She's a widow who's lost her husband. She is very privileged in background, or through her marriage, actually. And I really like the way you put it, how she's both protagonist and antagonist in a lot of ways. Initially, I thought, there's Muhammad Khan, the architect who wins this. Who else is arrayed around him? And I knew I wanted to tell the story from multiple points of view. So I said, you know, I looked actually at the actual 9/11 memorial competition, where there's one family member on the jury, and I thought, okay, so there will be a woman. So who is she? You know, I read a few memoirs of widows who had lost their husbands in September 11th, and I was thinking, initially I was really interested in the question of the almost political legacy of a marriage and what happens when events change your perception of the world. So I had read there were four widows in New Jersey. They became known as the Jersey Girls, who became very politically active. They really pushed for the 9/11 commission after September 11th. And one of them talked in her memoir about how she and her husband had been really staunch Republicans. And yet, because of September 11th, because of the way she perceived the government's response and her anger at not being able to get answers from President Bush and others, that she politically completely changed. And so that was one thing that factored into thinking about Claire, of who are you because of who you think your husband was, and trying to honor his memory, and yet you're living in a different world. And so what does that do to you, and what is the tension between those things? So that was part of it. And then in terms of her privilege, I think I was just interested in questions of power. And so much of the novel is with these different characters kind of structured as oppositions between them. So insiders and outsiders, and who is in the place to be making decisions. So that was part of it, is just the contrast. Initially, actually, part of it was the character of Sean Gallagher, who is the brother of the firefighter who died in these attacks. Initially, he was a woman who was also on the jury, but class-wise, very different from Claire. Initially, I was thinking, I always wanted class to be part of the novel, because I feel in so many political fights and discussions and controversies, it's sort of the elephant in the room. It's enormously important, but it doesn't get talked about or acknowledged often. You know, what is the sort of class difference between these two women, and how does that factor into how they respond to? And I felt, even in looking at some of the family members, the actual family members after September 11th, there was enormous variation in class, and that often affected how they approached the memorial and many of the other contentious issues that came up. I just felt that that was part of her story. That's part of how I thought about Claire. And then more and more, she just came to seem like a woman really trying to find herself through this process and sort of the instability of her foundation deep inside became central to the story in a lot of ways. And yet I was just rambling on, but I was also interested, there's another widow, for those of you who haven't read it, in the story, who is from Bangladesh. She's an illegal immigrant. Initially I was thinking, okay, she and Claire are completely opposite. Asma's in the shadows, she has no power, she has no money. And yet over time, and this happened a lot as I worked on the novel, I became very interested in the parallels between them as two women sort of trying to define themselves after the marriages that essentially define them have ended. So it was interesting to suddenly see them as very similar despite the extremely different external circumstances. Oh, yes. Yeah. So initially this Sean was Lucy, this widow who was also on the jury. The problem was she was just flat as a character. And I learned over time, you know, you sort of, especially coming from a journalistic background where you kind of plan out everything, you know, I had started out saying, all right, well, this is going to be this character Lucy, and she's going to stand for X, Y, and Z. And I realized fiction doesn't work well if you try to do that. And she just never came alive. And so one day I was getting on the subway in New York, and I thought, Lucy's meant to be a man. And it just came out of nowhere. And I started thinking about her as a man named, eventually became named Sean. And I also took him off the jury because I thought it was more interesting to have that tension of, you know, that he feels excluded in that sense. And again, these questions of who has power, who gets to make decisions. And he just worked, he worked much better as a man. You know, different scenes I worked on, he would plan the beginning of the scene, and by the end he would have done something I was not expecting, and it really, I thought that's who he is. He does things and then has to deal with the consequences, and Lucy fell on, you know, the cutting room floor. But I think the novel was actually much stronger as a result. Yes. So I'll repeat the question, which was why, given the multiple perspectives in the novel, is there not a more explicitly Jewish outlook or presence? And I think I thought a lot about it, and I felt, I mean, Paul is Jewish. It's a sort of, in a small way, figures in some of his outlook, and his wife, certainly. I think I just felt, partly I am Jewish as a novelist, it was more interesting to me to take some of my own experience but embed it in characters who were not like me. And so it was funny, somebody who knows me and read the book said, oh, Mo is just a male Muslim you. And I thought, you're kind of right in a way. I mean, I'm stubborn, but not quite that stubborn, but, you know, probably ambitious, but not that ambitious. But nonetheless, so many of questions about identity and your relationship to a group or a tribe, as a Jewish American, you wrestle with those all the time. And one person, you may defend Israel if you feel like they're attacking Israel, but with my family, I'll have fierce arguments, you know, where I'm saying, how can you defend Israel? Look at how they're behaving. You know, so these questions about the relationship between yourself as an individual and the identity you're trying to construct and the group that has a pull on you, and what are your obligations to that group, and how is your identity, you know, people have talked about this with Obama, your identity is constantly shifting in response to context and the arguments you make and the sides you take and so on. And I felt that with Mo, I just felt I was able to put a lot of that in Mo in a strange way. And I like that. It made me realize that even though these are very particular questions about these different groups, they're also universal. And so that was a big part of it. And it just didn't feel, there wasn't a character or place where it felt organic to the story to sort of have that be a big part of it. My sort of one rule in writing was just don't force anything because I think it should be there. It just, there was no character who came into my head who represented that particular viewpoint. And I did think from time to time, you know, should I have more of that? But I just felt like the fact that I was thinking about should I have more of it meant that I wasn't going to try to force it into, I feel like it gets written about a lot, it gets discussed a lot. I just didn't force it. But it's a good question.
Yes.
So let me repeat her question, which was, you know, that her book group read the book and struggled a little with aspects of both Mo and Claire. With Claire, was it her background or was it the arc of her? Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to talk too much about the ending for people who haven't read it. In fact, I won't talk at all. But I will say, to me, and then when people who haven't read it get to the ending, there is a lot of ambiguity embedded, or a lot of rue and regret embedded in the choices he makes in the end. I felt, you know, there is a yearning there for home. I can talk more about his character leading up to that and in Formation. I mean, I, as I said, I sort of enjoy him frustrating readers because I always wanted his character and his nature to be a part of the story, that he's shaping events rather than just being a passive victim of what's going on around him. And I read a lot about both just artists and architects working in the public sphere and also people kind of at the center of controversy. So for example, actually going back to your question, I read a whole cultural biography about the Dreyfus affair in France, where Alfred Dreyfus was a Jew who was accused of treason and nothing in common with Mohammed Khan, and yet he was very frustrating to his supporters because he refused to display emotion, he was very impassive, and they wanted more from him. That played in a little bit to Mohammed Khan. I read a lot about Maya Lin. I read about Jorn Utzon, who designed the Sydney Opera House, who, again, had this sort of, you have a sort of stubborn, rigid personality because you need it to push things through without compromise, and yet that ill-equips you to deal with the politics around you. But the central thing for me with Mo was that I wanted him to be a little bit inscrutable, or I felt like in the end the reader has to decide, do they trust him or not, and think about why. That was just one of the questions I wanted to leave you with. It's, for me, it was not as simple as he retreats into his Islamic background at all. So maybe, I don't know, maybe your group could go back and reread the ending and see if there's anything else there. I don't know. Yes. Yeah, so she said, I don't know if you could hear, she said she didn't feel he retreated into his Islamic background as much as becoming a successful American businessman. I mean, partly I think I have the line in there that he sort of capitalized on failure, which is a very American story in some ways. And also, you know, part of me, without giving away the ending, there are ways the world is changing and Americans more and more work abroad, have to engage with abroad, the rise of India and China and so on. And so part of it was about capturing some of that as well, that we no longer, America is not the only story anymore in a way. Yes. I have the idea. I have the way I think I want to structure it. And I've mostly just been doing a lot of reading and thinking and note-taking. I have not yet started writing. It's a weird thing to think about your second novel as opposed to your first, because, as I said, with your first, you're just not aware of publishing it or audience or anything. And so I literally just started writing when I had a little window of time. With this one, I'm just more cautious in a way, which I'm not sure is a good thing, but you know, I feel like I want to think more about what I'm doing and how I'm going to write it. And at some point, I'm probably just going to have to go for it and stop thinking. So the question was the controversy around the proposed Islamic Community Center near Ground Zero, which kind of broke into the news in mid-2010. Was it an influence? So are you saying, was it an influence on the writing of the novel? Or so would that controversy, kind of what relationship does it have? Or what does it reveal maybe about how people might think about a Muslim architect being chosen? I mean, what was interesting when that happened, I had finished my first draft and I'd been working on the novel for a few years, but I really had started to think of it as more of a historical novel than a contemporary novel, in the sense that things in New York at least just seemed almost normal. And I had started to think, you know, maybe these feelings I'm exploring are gone, and that I'm just writing about this particular piece of history 2 years after the attack. And I think when that happened, I realized, and I sort of thought to myself, maybe it wouldn't be a big deal if someone named Mohammed Khan won and everybody would be fine with it. And why did I invent this whole story? And then when that happened, I thought, okay, it would be a big deal. Those feelings are still there. And it was really instructive for me. This was already very strongly in the book, but it really made me think even more about it. I feel like so much of the book is about, the less interesting part of the book to me is about the kind of overt hatred, prejudice, fear, etc. And the more interesting part is with Claire, for example, just the ambivalence deep inside us, the unacknowledged feelings and emotions. And I saw a lot of that, or had a lot of conversations around that with that controversy, because friends who you'd start out a conversation with them and they would say, of course they have the right to put it there and that's ridiculous, this is America. But as the conversation went on, they'd sort of say, I just wish they would put it 12 blocks away instead of two. And I felt like people were deep down wrestling still with those doubts and uncertainties and suspicions. And, you know, you'd sort of say, well, why? And, well, I'm not saying they did it, but it just makes me people can't even articulate really what's deep down. And so that to me was sort of I wouldn't say it's the most important thing in the book at all, but it is one of the places I felt like the book and fiction can work in a way. Because if you can't even articulate emotions you're having, you're certainly not going to articulate them to a journalist, but they're there. And I've had a lot of readers write to me and say, just reading the book, it made me wrestle with, you know, some of what I have, the fears I have when I get on an airplane and see someone in traditional Muslim dress and so on. And I think this, especially but not at all exclusively for New Yorkers, there's just still some of that there, even 10 years on. So the question is about how so many of the characters seem to have ulterior motives and say one thing publicly but often have a whole other agenda operating. I just felt like again, I think this is what fiction can do, is there's always a more complicated story under what any of us present as our public selves, and we all have whole psychological and personal histories, and one of my concerns in writing the novel was how do those histories and psychological makeups and so on shape public events, because we often segregate them, or, you know, we all... I wanted to explore the connections between them, and I also felt that we have public selves and private selves, and we all have more complicated motives than we often want to admit to. And, you know, maybe it's a slightly cynical view of human nature, but I think it's just human nature that we do have rivalries with our siblings that would be complicated by a heroic death in a lot of ways. And to me, that made someone like Sean just very human to be reacting the way he did. But he's not going to stand up and say, I feel this way about my brother, and I feel in his... You know, you act often without even realizing you're acting on these feelings and impulses. You know, I also, the way the book is structured, where you're both, one minute you're inside a character's head, and then in the next scene you're in another character's head watching that character, I felt it allows you to see these gaps between how we read people, and when you encounter a person in a public encounter, you make a lot of assumptions about them. You're often mystified by their behavior. To be able to almost take a reader behind the scenes, behind the mental scenes, and say, here's what's really going on. In an ideal world, maybe when you actually encounter real people, that's in your head a tiny bit of, oh, there's actually a whole other world working inside their head that explains why they're being a jerk to me, why they're acting the way they do. That was some of my thinking. If anybody didn't hear the question, it's when did this shorthand essentially of 9/11 take hold and why? That sounds right to me, but I'm not sure. I don't remember. You know, I actually remember noticing more Ground Zero, because initially it was sort of just a metaphor, right? Because I can't even remember the original meaning or use of Ground Zero. Is it for a nuclear attack or... Right, so initially it was just used as kind of a metaphor, and then, you know, to me, it's so interesting. At what point did this just become the name of this place? And everybody took it for granted that this is Ground Zero, and it was just a metaphor initially, kind of. But I think you're right that journalists do seek shorthands, so I think a lot of it does come from journalists. And in the whole writing of the book, I made the decision never to use 9/11 or Ground Zero. For that reason is that I think it's just become this shorthand that, in a way, it's almost deadens, I think, a reader who sees it, because, you know, as soon as you see 9/11, it just conjures up, you know, either you sort of glaze over because we've all read so much about it, or it conjures up your personal experience of that day. And I felt like I don't want those shorthands and kind of buzzwords that we don't even think about what we're really talking about when we use them. So, but I don't know exactly when it took hold, but it's an interesting question. I think in Britain, the subway attacks, I think they're often called 7/7 or referred to as 7/7. Yeah. 2008. Well, for a while I was working on a book of short stories all connected to the economic collapse. I don't think I'm going to pursue it because I think I'm more of a novel writer than a short story writer, but I was calling it The Day Lehman Died because I felt like I kept meeting people who, the most random mix of people who would say, oh yeah, you know, I was doing great as an artist until the day Lehman Brothers died and my phone stopped ringing, you know, a guy trying to sell his B&B in upstate New York who said I was going to sell it and then I knew the day Lehman Brothers died I wouldn't be able to sell. You know, everybody kept tracing it to that particular day. And so I was thinking the day Lehman died, you know, sums up everything. But, you know, I don't know if I'll ever write that book. Yes. It definitely emerged organically. I mean, I think I knew, you know, the one thing I'll say about the ending, it projects forward in time. I think that I knew fairly early on I wanted to do. But I didn't know what you would see there. And I felt like that had to emerge organically from the story and the characters and kind of their alchemy. And I don't remember. Then it kind of came piece by piece. I mean, there was the sort of basic decision of does the garden get built or not, which I'm not going to reveal, but that I had to resolve. But then just there were other elements that became part of the ending much later in the process. But I think I always felt like moving in time was just something I wanted to do because so much of the novel takes place in this very compressed, kind of feverish time that I felt like the characters can't even see outside of it or see beyond it. So it was partly that and partly just what does time and aging do to all of us and how we see our past and events we were part of. And I just felt emotionally it introduced a different tone that's more about regret and rue in a way than for a book where people are so, at least publicly, dug in and rigid for so much of the book. What would, I just wanted something that felt different.
She said that I gave away more than she would have asked in her question. We'll be having a seminar in the next room about the ending after
after the meeting.
All right, so you.
So the question was about, as I've been on book tour and hearing from readers, were there things that surprised me or, and also in particular groups struggling with questions of identity, how have they responded to or received the novel? Is that a fair? I mean, for me, I think the really interesting thing, so the book's been out about 8 months, is I almost feel like the conversations and responses to me have become part of the novel itself. Just in people react very differently and they take it very personally in a way that I didn't expect and they take sides and they're not always predictable sides. I mean, to me, some of the most interesting responses are, you know, liberals, for example, who want to kill Mo. I like that, frankly, but it's very interesting to me. They're almost angry at me because it's not easy for them. You know, they want it to be easy to root for him and it's not always easy to root for him. Claire, people sometimes feel very personally betrayed in a way because they've identified her with her to a point. And then, you know, the one thing I realized early on is that once you publish a novel, you don't own it anymore. There were responses that discomforted me or surprised me, but I can't say, that's not right. That's not what I meant. You know, no, you can't think that about X, Y, or Z. I don't own it anymore. And so that I've had a certain process of surrender. I have heard from quite a few Muslim Americans who read the book, and I've met with some groups. And again, the same idea that the conversations feel like an extension of the novel in a really interesting way, because even if, as they usually are, they're very different from Mo, you know, they don't drink or, you know, do many of the things he does, just these same questions about, is it our responsibility to assuage the fears about us? You know, why should we have to do that as Americans? But is it self-destructive not to do? These are the conversations people, Muslims, are still having. I've had people stand up and say, how long are we going to have to sort of, just again, was stopped at the airport or whatever, how long are we going to have to pay a price for our fellow Americans feeling secure? So it's just, to me, been very moving to kind of hear and witness some of these conversations. So the question is about, they're actually still building. They just topped it with a floor that now makes it taller than the Empire State Building, the new, I think technically it's not called the Freedom Tower anymore as it was originally, but this building being built right next to the site, you know, so the question is sort of, was there controversy about it and this impulse to, again, build high? And yeah, I think there was some controversy about it. There was certainly a debate about how do we respond architecturally. And to me, I look at that building and I see kind of, there is America over the last decade embodied in that building, both the we will come back stronger, taller, we cannot be defeated, and yet the entire first 12 floors are pure concrete because we don't want to be, you know, we don't want it to be car bombed, and so it looks horrible. A lot of the book, in a way, is about how architecture embodies so many of our fears and anxieties and evolution, and so I just, that to me is what that building is. It's not a great building. I think the desire to go taller than the Empire State Building is just feels slightly juvenile to me. I don't know, but that's just one woman's opinion. I don't know. So the question is sort of about why haven't there been more novels that deal with September 11th? I think there's probably been more than you think. I think some of them are very good novels, but not necessarily because of the way they deal with September 11th. Sometimes it's almost like a plot device of here's the disaster that changes everything. And that, I mean, there's been an interesting mix. I haven't read Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, but, you know, my sense that is about sort of grief and loss. But then there's The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which I don't know if any of you have heard of, is a totally different kind of book. It's about a Pakistani-American who goes back to his country and it has these very ambivalent feelings about America. So there's a whole range. I didn't feel like there were very many, if any, that really dealt with just the aftermath in America and these questions of who are we now and, you know, what values needed to be renegotiated because of this, which didn't. And certainly very few about just American Muslims as sort of complex human characters. You know, I think with time there will be a growing body of literature. I'm always, even when my book came out, people said, oh, here's the 9/11 novel. And I don't think there is or should be a 9/11 novel. There's too much connected to it that I think it will over time require a body of literature to deal with or for readers. So the question is about the Asma, the Bangladeshi widow in the book, but also the whole community of immigrants and many illegal immigrants that she's part of. When did that sort of become part of the story? I can't remember exactly when I first started thinking about Asma as a character. I think as I was reading old news stories and things, looking at when I started working on the novel, I think there were widows from Bangladesh or Pakistan or something. So I started thinking about just that idea, going back to Claire being sort of the ultimate insider. What would it feel like to be entirely outside of this process and yet have the same investment in it? And so that idea really stayed with me, and I started thinking about Asma. And, you know, I had covered New York a lot before September 11th and just had always been very interested in these different communities kind of existing side by side, and yet we kind of see them but don't see them. And so trying to capture, I actually, one of the very few people in the book who is inspired by a real person is Nasruddin, who is sort of the mayor of Little Dhaka, because my landlord when I lived in Brooklyn in the late 90s had Bangladeshis do repair a lot of brownstones. And there was this guy who was amazing to me because he was always telling me, yeah, I fix everything for my community and I'm doing this and trying to deal with the schools. And I just wanted to have that face in the book. And you know, I always really just liked him as a character. So that was there. And then the piece about her being illegal but getting this payout came later, because I read a news story about that was the actual situation for a small group of 9/11 families where they were illegal, or their husbands or spouses were illegal. And so they did get compensation, yet had to hide, essentially, until a couple years ago Congress gave them permanent residency, I think. It was interesting, even the way the form of the book, I felt like, mirrored the actual real life, in the sense that you are reading about Asma for so much of the book without exactly knowing why you're reading about her, because she doesn't intersect with the plot. I mean, she's literally outside of it. And yet, so I, as a writer, had to think, how do I hold your interest in this person, even though you have no idea why you're reading about her? And so it sort of, to me, mimicked life in a way of how do you get people to see and care about these people, even if they don't have a direct reason to. So the title, the submission, how did I come upon it? My original title when I was working on the book was The Garden. And I had that for a while, and then I was, once I had an agent and before he found a publisher, I was talking to him and saying, I just feel like it's a little bit flat, and he said, oh yeah, I think so too, even though he had never said anything before that. So we were talking, and sort of, I think he first said, if it was about a woman, it would be great to call it The Submission, and I thought, actually, if it was about a woman, I would never call it The Submission because that would just be wrong and creepy, but I don't see why it matters. You know, it actually works incredibly well because it's about a submission to a competition and Islam meaning, you know, submission to God. And so that was my original, you know, here's why I like this. It at least has these two meanings. But then as I was working on the book, yeah, it was interesting as a writer to keep suddenly discovering new resonances for the title constantly with all of the characters and just realizing that in a way that's one of the central questions of the novel is when do you submit and why and to whom and what is your relationship to family, religion, country, and, you know, again, going back to these ideas about how do you as an individual, and especially in America, which is so much about the individual, and yet we are also tied to these various loyalties. I was very happy with the title. I don't have a title for my next book, and it's really bothering me. I do, but it's an unwieldy title, so I have to keep working on that. I submitted the manuscript. The funny thing was, my publisher, when he bought it, he said, "I kind of think it should just be called The Garden." And I said, "No, I've been there. We're not calling it The Garden." But the entire time, right up until publication, he kept balking at the title. And he finally said, "It's because all I do all day is get submissions of people submitting manuscript. It's not a poetic word to me." You know, it's really funny. But my editor kept saying to him, "It's the best title. Just leave it alone." it's kind of funny. Anyway, thank you so much. After I do signing, if anybody has questions about the ending or something that they want to talk about, we could do that separately.
I have another idea. Okay, normally in Seattle Reads, we do get to talk about and we get to ask the author about the ending. You will remember, those of you who were here last year when Chris Cleave was here, he gave, I thought, one of the most thoughtful, interesting answers about why an ambiguous ending. So those of you who have read the book, You stay here for, you know, 5 minutes, okay? Okay, good.
Okay, so maybe, you know, I'm going to let you kind of ask your question as you would like to ask it. That's what I meant about how time changes how you see things, and I don't think it's a clear-cut ending at all, and even looking at Claire sort of apologizing and being angry, nothing is nobody's purely changed. Part of it for me, too, is that in some ways I feel like we've kind of moved past 9/11, and part of the book is saying we should move past it in the sense that it's become this religion. And yet, at the same time, I did want in the end to also say these are losses that will never, they're permanent absences, and what does it mean to live with that and have you shape your life? Yeah. I felt like, partly because I had lived in South Asia and just felt more comfortable writing about someone from that background, I felt like I knew it better. And I also felt like, you know, the majority of Muslims in the world are outside of the Middle East. It's not a fact we hear often, but it's true. And so I thought, why should he be from the Middle East? You know, just because that's sort of what we're afraid of and focused on. But if you're just writing about a Muslim, he could be from Indonesia because that has more Muslims, I think, than any country in the world. And so that's why it was sort of to push back against that and say, there's no reason he should be from the Middle East. I thought about, you know, would it be even a bigger deal if he was from the Middle East? But I kind of felt like, In American eyes, a Muslim's a Muslim. You know, at least in this controversy, I didn't think it needed that for him to be scary to Americans. And part of the point also was how we project our fears, whether or not they're warranted, so that it didn't matter where he was from or what his background was or whether he was religious or not. You know, that is part of the story, that it just didn't matter. Once people began to see him a certain way and project a lot around him, it didn't matter what his background was. Also sort of the point is that he was an architect, and certainly in his own mind, well before he was a Muslim. And so the whole book is about him saying, wait a minute. Frankly, that a lot of that came from reading about Maya Lin, who she literally, I read one interview with her, she said, I saw myself as white. Like, it was shocking to her when people were writing in saying, you're a gook, how can you design this? You know, because she grew up in Athens, Ohio. And so how you self-identify and what's important to you in your identity versus what the world is imposing on you. That was it. He is forced into a corner in a way, and there are things that come out of it, exploring his relationship to Islam and what Islam is comes out of this. But he is primarily an architect, and, you know, yes, I read a lot about architects and tried to capture a lot of that personality. And to me, yes, the course of the book is shaped much more by that personality than, in a way, by anything that comes out of him being a Muslim. She said that she loved the ending because of the ambiguity. No, I mean, one of the things in the ending, I was telling Chris this, I think, you know, with the Quran being on the walls, I had a woman come up to me at a reading, and she said, I just want to know what it says. And I said, the whole point is that you don't know, and you have to decide what you think, and you have think about why do you think what you think. You know, that's kind of where I want to leave you in a way. But it was funny because she said, I just need to know what it says so I can know what to think. And I was kind of like, I'm not going to tell you what to think. So.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.